This is an interview with Richard Beckler for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is May 9th, 2012. We're talking at Mr. Beckler's office at Bracewell & Giuliani in Washington, D.C. Mr. Beckler, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Yeah, great. For us, too. So I understand you were born in Brooklyn. Did you grow up in New York City?
I grew up in Brooklyn. I was born in Flatbush and one section of Brooklyn. When I was about 10 or 11 years old, we moved to Brooklyn Heights. My mother lived in the, father lived in the same apartment for 50-odd years in Brooklyn Heights.
Now, when you were young, did you always know that you wanted to be a lawyer when you grew up?
No, I actually wasn't sure. I went to Williams College. I was a history major at Williams and then graduated from Williams in 1961. And it was the age of the draft. I went to Navy OCS, became a naval officer.
Mm-hmm. Where did you serve?
And I spent most of my time on an aircraft carrier, the USS Yorktown.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on the ship, the Yorktown, that I was, although I had no law degree, of course, I was made an assistant legal officer. And in those days, you didn't have to have a law degree to do either summary or special court martials. So for many of the years on the time I was on the ship, I participated in court martials as either trial counsel, which is what the prosecutor is called in military justice, or defense counsel. And from that experience, got interested in going to law school.
So you ended up going to Fordham Law School?
That's correct. I applied my last year in the Navy. I applied to a law school, got into Fordham, and I went to Fordham.
Mm-hmm. Did you focus on criminal justice there?
No, I pretty much knew where I wanted to work. I knew I wanted to work in the DA's office in Manhattan, but I only took, you know, two criminal courses in law school. Otherwise, it was a general law school curriculum.
Did you want to work at the DEA's office primarily because you wanted to return to New York City, or were you more interested in the type of work that they did?
Well, of course, Fordham was located in New York City, so I was stationed on the West Coast in the Navy. So I came back to New York, and I wanted to get trial experience, and I knew the best place to do it was the DEA's office in Manhattan. So I applied there. It was the only job I applied to, and fortunately I got the job.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Hogan was a DA then. He had succeeded Tom Dewey in that job in the early 1940s and remained DA until he died in the early 70s.
What sorts of cases did you work on there?
Well, of course, you start out as a young DA. You do misdemeanor cases and complaint bureau. Loitering, prostitution, those kinds of cases. And then you work your way up to more serious felonies. And then ultimately I wound up in the fraud section of the DA's office and started doing some fraud prosecutions, which was actually in those days fairly new. We had a big scandal involving the Housing and Urban Development and the HEW. This is on a citywide basis, not federal. And those sort of fraud prosecutions were unusual in those days.
New York City was a much different city in some ways back then in terms of crime, in terms of...
Yeah, actually, it was... I was in the DA's office from 1968 until 1973, and it was going crazy. It was, you could make a movie every day. There was police corruption with the Serpico case and the movie, Columbia student riots, Cambodian invasion, riots, black power, crime was out of control. The city was pretty different then, pretty militant. And there were a lot of problems, a lot of economic problems, a lot of crime problems, much different than it is today.
Was Rudy Giuliani working in the office at that time?
Rudy Giuliani at that time was in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District, which was the federal counterpart to the Manhattan DA's office. Mm-hmm. Very close rivalry. In fact, at that time, Morgenthau was the U.S. attorney and Frank Hogan was the DA, and they had sort of a rivalry. Subsequently, of course, Morgenthau became the DA, held that job for 4 years himself.
Right. Okay. So how did you make the transition to the Department of Justice from the New York DA's office?
Well, I had thought about going down to Washington for a short period, and I wound up getting... offered a job by the fraud section of the criminal division of the U.S. Department of Justice. So I went down to Washington in 72, I think it was, 72, 73. and became a line attorney in the fraud section, although pretty quickly I was made head of this major violators unit, then head of the SEC prosecution unit, then subsequently deputy chief of the section, and then chief of the section. And I spent, I guess, about 7 years at Maine Justice.
Did they give you any training or orientation when you got there, or did they just throw you on cases?
Well, mine was unusual because when I went to the fraud section, there were very few lawyers in the section who actually tried cases. It's much different. The fraud section today at the Justice Department usually recruits seasoned assistant U.S. attorneys or state prosecutors who have tried cases. When I went there, it didn't have those kinds of people, so I was lucky in one sense that I'd had a lot of trial experience in the DA's office in Manhattan. So when I got there to Justice, they needed people with hands-on trial experience. And the way I got involved with the Securities Exchange Commission was that the SEC in those days, of course, still true today, as you know, the SEC has no criminal jurisdiction. They cannot try a criminal case. They can get a special assignment as an assistant U.S. attorney and try it along with the U.S. attorney, but they can't try them themselves. So most of the SEC cases that were prosecuted in those days were prosecuted in the Southern District of New York, the U.S. Attorney's Office. But there are lots of securities cases, fraud cases, 10b-5, other kinds of fraud, boiler room, shops, misrepresentations, 10b-5s, manipulation, and so on, that occurred in other districts, other federal districts. So we had this unit at the Justice Department that would try those cases in the other districts. Therefore, I tried a securities case up in Boston. I tried one in Philadelphia. I tried several of them out in Utah. Because in those days, again, the U.S. Attorney's offices in those jurisdictions didn't have the people qualified to do SEC, unlike the Southern District, which has always had a cadre of, of prosecutors who are familiar with SEC prosecutions. So I went out on the road and tried those cases. Now, a lot of those same U.S. attorney's offices, particularly Philadelphia or Boston, now have that capability. But back 30 years, 40 years ago almost now, in the early 70s, they didn't.
It's relatively rare.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And my understanding is that you showed up in town just as the Watergate hearings were beginning.
That's correct. Yep. Okay.
Was that something that people in the Justice Department were talking about a lot?
Well, of course... The Justice Department, I would say the career Justice Department people, for the most part, it was a Democratic establishment. And in fact, in those days, I was certainly more of a Democrat than I am today. And it was not much love, at least among the Justice Department, for Nixon. In fact, very few people. He had very few fans in Washington those years, Nixon. It did have, of course, you know, the various attorney generals, of course, those were appointed by Nixon, came under fire, as you know. But I would say the overriding effect of Watergate actually is what occurred, is what caused the creation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in an interesting way. I can tell you a little bit about that if you'd like.
Well, that absolutely. First, though, let me just ask you about one thing that you mentioned.
Sure.
You talked about the career staff within the Justice Department as being mostly Democratic. Did you notice a big split within the DOJ between career staff and maybe people that only expected to be there for a few years before going back into private practice or going somewhere else?
There's always in any bureaucracy, in Justice Department, there are always the career guys. They're usually pretty much straight shooters. You know, they may be Democrats, but they pretty much call it as they see it. Whereas, as administrations change, as you know, the Attorney General serves at the pleasure of the President, and then that filters down. There's political slots all through the Justice Department. The head of the criminal division, the Assistant Attorney General in charge of criminal, would be the party of the President. So I served under Phil Hyman, who was a Democrat, Dick Thornburg, who was a Republican, Ben Civiletti, who was a Democrat, and went back and forth during the years that I was there. Went from Republican to Democrat, back to Republican. So, but, and there was always a certain, I don't know if tension's the right word, but there were always a lot of career prosecutors at DOJ who felt that oftentimes the assistant attorney general, or more likely the associate, the deputy assistant attorney generals, were not qualified for the job. They were often political appointees, mm-hmm. appointed by a political appointee,
right.
And they weren't that qualified. So there's always that tension.
When you entered the Justice Department, did you expect to stay there for a number of years, or did you think, well, 2 or 3 years, and then I'll go into private practice?
Well, it's funny. When I went down to Washington originally, I thought I would stay there just a few years and go back to New York, because I still love New York. That's where my home is. I still have a vacation house up there and a small apartment that I rent up there. I had no intention of staying in D.C., but the more I was at the fraud section, the more I liked it. I didn't think I could duplicate the years I had in the DA's office in terms of the volume of trying cases, but when I was a justice, I got pretty lucky. I used to have lots of trials all over the country, got to meet lots of defense lawyers and prosecutors from all over the country, which is a nice network of people to know, and so I just stayed. And ultimately, the reason I left, I mean, I had, what, almost 11 years of prosecutor by the time I left between the Manhattan DA's office and Justice. And the reason I left was twofold. One, I don't think you should be a prosecutor lifelong, number one.
Why not, if you don't mind me
saying? I think you get too jaundiced, basically. I think you ought to step aside after X number of years as a prosecutor, get too one-sided. And then, of course, monetary reasons. I have a lot of children. I have 6 kids. I was having more kids, becoming increasingly more and more teetering on the edge of bankruptcy, so to speak. Not really, but, you know. So that was a driving force, too. But I would have left in any event.
Okay. All right, well, let's move back a little bit towards Watergate and the origins of the Foreign Corrupt sure. Practices Act. What is the relationship between these two?
Well, Watergate explored, of course, all these, some of these outside committees that were supporting the president, so on and so forth. And at some point, there came to be a concentration, if you will, on donations to the Republican Party, and then donations to congressmen, and donations to senators, and so on and so forth. And there was a famous case involving ITT, a big corporation, and Dita Beard, her name was, she was a lobbyist, and how she would distribute money around Capitol Hill, and there was lots of talk about political bribes, mm-hmm. pay for play, as they call it today. Mm-hmm. And in fact, by that time, in the late 70s, I was deputy head of the fraud section, and there were a few cases left over from the special prosecutors. You had Archibald Cox and Leon Jaworski, then several others in succession. And by the time they closed the special prosecutor's office down, there were still a few cases left. And one of them involved a fellow by the name of Claude Wilde, who was a
right.
who was a lobbyist, I believe, on behalf of IT&T. And he was represented by Bill Hundley, who died a few years ago, a wonderful defense lawyer. And he came to my office to try to work out a disposition for his client, Claude Wilde. And I was acting as, I was a career justice guy at that point, but I was acting for the office of the special prosecutor in the sense that those cases were just sort of airlifted over to DOJ. And this fellow talked about, he said he could go up to Congress that day. This was in the late 70s.
You're talking about Claude Wilde here.
Claude Wilde. He said he could go up there with a wheelbarrow of money today and mm-hmm. distribute it and be emptied out in an hour.
Yeah.
This was after all the yelling and hooting and prosecutions and so on. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, he wound up pleading guilty. He got time, so he didn't really do any time in jail. But out of all of that came the report that IT&T was not only making domestic political payments, but they perhaps were bribing politicians all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Was that illegal at this time?
No. There was no Foreign Corrupt Practices Act at that time.
So
it was illegal in the sense that along the way to doing it, you could violate other statutes, such as transporting currency in excess of $10,000 without declaring it in customs, or if you were, you could, they could try to construct some sort of a mail or wire fraud. But it was largely they were prosecuted by currency transportation statutes or use of the mail or wire fraud statute.
Had
a
some
scheme
case
to defraud.
Yeah. So these legal measures were available, but to your knowledge, had any cases really been prosecuted up until that time, or many cases?
As far as I know, there were no prosecutions ever for bribing a foreign government official. In fact, to tell you the truth, outside of price fixing against GE, there virtually were no white-collar prosecutions of corporations for anything other than antitrust price fixing. Just didn't exist. You know, the reason I say that is, jumping ahead just a minute, when
All right, so we were talking about whether or not there were any prosecutions to the FCPA or before the Watergate.
Yeah, there really weren't any prosecutions of big companies other than price fixing. There was a notorious case in which GE was involved in price fixing. The reason I say that is what, as before, after this whole question came up about American companies paying bribes overseas, the Attorney General appointed a task force to head it up, and I was named the person in charge of that task force. So I then had attorneys assigned to me from different government agencies, some from the SEC, some from the Internal Revenue Service, some from other divisions in the Justice Department, as well as FBI agents, customs agents, Internal Revenue Service agents. And at the same time, the SEC was asking for companies to make voluntary disclosures to them if they had made any foreign payments. So they had their voluntary disclosure program going on.
And that was not coordinated with the DOJ, at least at first?
Not at first, but we kept talking with each other to some extent. Stanley Sporkin was head of the enforcement section. I was driving the train from Justice. Earl Silbert got involved, too. He was the U.S. attorney in D.C. at the time. But I sent out probably 50 grand jury subpoenas to American companies. It was like a shockwave. Most of these companies had never had a grand jury subpoena before.
Now, was this something that the Attorney General was keen on prosecuting?
Yeah, he wanted us to find out, yeah.
Do you think that came from higher up within the administration? Either, I guess it might have been the Ford administration by that point, or was this already under Nixon that the investigations began?
This would have been after 76.
Okay, all right. So
this would have been Griffin Bell.
Right.
Yeah, 76, Carter was elected.
Right.
And this was in 76 time frame.
So Ford administration.
It may have started kicked in 75, some activity, come to think of it. I'd have to check on that.
Right.
During the Ford presidency.
Yeah. Well, the SEC's, program had already started in, I think, 1975.
It had, okay.
Yeah, exactly. They had this voluntary disclosure program where corporations would come forward and disclose whatever sort of bribery had gone on, with the understanding that, well, maybe they wouldn't be prosecuted, but there was no really explicit guarantee about that, right?
Right. Uh-huh. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And then we, at the Justice Department, there are some cases we locked into an actual prosecution. So Lockheed in Japan involving the Prime Minister Tanaka. And other cases were pursued for a number of years, Westinghouse, Ford, and some resulted in pleas. Some just kind of ended without. It's always been very difficult, and still is today, to get hard evidence from a foreign country, even if it's a friendly foreign country. yeah. as to an actual bribe being paid.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that here in just a second. First, just let me ask you something. So, during these early years, one of the methods that the SEC certainly was using to catch these companies was basically tax reasons, because these companies had funds that they were using to pay bribes, whether foreign or domestic, that were not being disclosed as in a proper fashion, right?
Right.
Now, looking back on this, it seems like a kind of a funny way to catch someone for paying a bribe.
Yeah, but still commonly used today. Bribe payments today are, you know, often right down to these most recent cases, they're often put on the books as consulting payments or legal fees or some such thing. Mm-hmm. So you get a books and records issue, which, if your books and records are not accurate, implies a mail or wire fraud. You're deceiving someone. That's how the mail and wire fraud mm-hmm. statute track in there, which was why when the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was written, there really was an incorporation of the mail and wire fraud statutes mm-hmm. with an overlay of including a specific category of participants, such as foreign government officials.
Mm-hmm.
But does that answer your question?
Yeah, that does answer the question. Yeah, that explains that process a little bit. Yep. So how were the relations between the SEC and the DOJ on this issue at that time? Was one party maybe pushing the other more for prosecutions or some sort of action?
I would say, well, we worked pretty well together, yep. I would say, generally. There's always a little bit of competition between DOJ and the SEC because DOJ feels that the SEC really doesn't have to ever really try their cases. You know, they'd get this and neither admit nor deny, and we're not as conscious of what evidence you really needed to bring. Now, I say that not only as a defense lawyer today, but even back as a prosecutor. Sometimes the SEC was able to stretch a settlement because, you know, the company comes in and they neither admit nor deny, so mm-hmm. what? So the government... The SEC really doesn't have that proof. Whereas if you go in, either you take a plea in a criminal case or you go to trial, you better have the evidence. Because if you don't have the evidence, the judge isn't going to accept the plea. And if you don't have the evidence, you're going to lose a trial. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole different ballgame in that sense. But having said that, there was a lot of cooperation between the agencies, between Justice and the SEC.
Okay. Yeah. I think it was in October 76 that the Department of Justice formed the TAC. Task force under
okay.
your direction. That's the date I have here from,
right. okay.
from
that sounds about right.
the news articles. Right. In your investigations, were you mostly just looking at the data that the SEC had compiled, or were you going out and actively investigating companies
Both.
In the United States? Were you also going abroad to investigate?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How did that play out on a typical case?
Well, you know, I had attorneys who would go overseas on different matters and travel around, work with customs agents, in some instances try to make contact with the so-called people who are passing the bribes, the foreign agents. We also used a lot of data from that had been submitted voluntarily to the SEC. We put people in grand juries. So we had different sources of information.
There are obviously a lot of potential cases you could have been working on. Were you limited a little bit by manpower in terms
Absolutely.
Of what you could investigate?
You know, there were 100 more, probably 200 corporations. Somewhere I have a list, that's what I was looking for a moment ago, somewhere I have a list of those initial corporations that made disclosures.
Mm-hmm.
Enormous number of companies made voluntary disclosures to the SEC. Mm-hmm. And we obviously were not going to be able to prosecute all of them. So we did a selective sampling, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So when you traveled abroad to investigate these cases, the attorneys probably talked with American businessmen. They probably talked with government officials
right.
From other countries.
Right.
Were people very cooperative?
Oftentimes not, no.
Right.
It's very difficult to get people to cooperate. And of course, you have to be very careful. In most foreign countries, or most other countries, you cannot... interview foreign citizens on foreign soil. You have to get them to agree to come into the American embassy
mm-hmm.
and be interviewed. You can't extend your criminal jurisdiction into, even today, if you wanted to go interview somebody for a criminal case in England, you'd have to do it through the embassy.
Could you make much of an argument to them that it was in their interest to do so?
Well, you know, for the next, you could, but, you know, for the most part, most of the other countries in the world were not interested in prosecuting bribery cases, which is why after I left the Justice Department, there was a fellow named Mark Richard. His name has probably come up in your research. He's now deceased, but he spent a great deal of his time trying to get these OECD treaties together, these economic mm-hmm. treaties whereby countries would cooperate with one another.
Right. This was in, I think, in the 80s and 90s, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So,
right. To get more cooperation. Finally, a lot of companies signed a treaty. But frankly, even today, you know, 2012, most countries are still not very interested in prosecuting foreign bribery cases mm-hmm. outside the U.S.
Right.
The U.S. does it. Britain does it a little bit. Germany did it a little bit in the Siemens case. France have done it a very little bit. But for the most part, we're the only country prosecuting these cases
right.
today.
Yeah. So let's just go back to the mid-1970s. Was there a lot of interest at a high political level in pursuing these cases, or were there some concerns about the possible ramifications either on American business or diplomacy?
Well, that's a very good question. There were concerns because when you get to the very highest level of accusing, as is the case in Japan, a prime minister of accepting a bribe, you're definitely delving into foreign policy, if you will, or foreign relations. Ergo, it was decided that the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act would only be prosecuted within main justice and only within the fraud section, so that the political apparatus could, to some extent, control the cases. You couldn't have an assistant U.S. attorney in Illinois send out a grand jury subpoena subpoenaing people for violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, even though there could be an Illinois-based corporation that made a bribe overseas and there was jurisdiction and everything else. It was all done through main justice. And that was not unprecedented. That's true of tax cases. It's essentially true of antitrust cases. Cases that have a broad implication are really much more tightly controlled.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a decision, and that was the right decision to make. Yes, these cases were very political, many of them.
Mm-hmm.
I went to lots of hearings on the Hill to defend either the justice's prosecution of or lack of prosecution of a particular case for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
And they were always somewhat high profile, often involving big companies with the CEOs of the companies.
Mm-hmm.
We had one where the CEO of Textron was also the Secretary of Treasury, became the Secretary of Treasury after he was CEO, and so on and so forth. So mm-hmm. lots of
right.
political interest.
Yep. My understanding is that the Ford administration formed a high-level task force to actually investigate the issue of bribery abroad in March 1976, and it had Elliot Richardson, Henry Kissinger, Donald Rumsfeld. Do you recall that impacting the Justice Department's work at all, or were these sort of separate things, you know, maybe a political panel, and then...
What was it?
Well, it was in March 1976, and this is just from newspaper reporting.
My task force was in October
right.
of 1976. This is in March.
Well, yeah, yours was in October, and this was in March, so it obviously happened before the task force was formed.
I don't remember much about that task force.
Well, if it wasn't formed, it probably didn't have much impact then.
I don't remember much about it.
Okay.
I know all those names. But,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. If you don't mind, I'd like to talk about a couple of specific cases that you worked on. One of the first big ones was Williams Companies,
right.
if you recall that, which was a Tulsa-based energy company, and I think they had some fertilizer interests. And my understanding is that in March 1978, they pleaded guilty after there had been an 18-month investigation. Do you recall much about that case?
No.
Okay.
I really don't. It was one of the cases in the task force. It was handled by guys who worked under me, but I signed off on it, but I don't remember a lot about the facts
right.
of it.
Well, it was settled by a plea bargaining agreement, and as part of that plea bargaining agreement, they basically agreed or were granted permission not to disclose the governments or officials that had been bribed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, was that a pretty common feature of these plea bargaining agreements?
Yes, it was. This is again for foreign policy reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you could get away with that today. Disclosure world we live in today. But, yeah, it was done quite, you know, for security reasons, national security reasons. Sometimes it was better not to. And I do recall in that case, now that you mention it, some of the people involved, but I think we had an agreement it wasn't going to be disclosed, and nobody balked at it, so that's the way it went down. The judge took the plea without a public disclosure.
Right. Yeah. Another big case at the time was Lockheed Corporation. And so there had been revelations that Lockheed had paid a lot of money in bribes abroad. I think the total was $38 million to officials in 17 countries, including a $1 million payment to Prince Bernard of the Netherlands.
Right.
Obviously, this had huge repercussions in the internal politics of these countries. I think Prince Bernard had to step down as the head of the army or something like that. Can you tell me a little bit about how the discussion within the Justice Department or between the Justice Department and the administration played out?
Well, again, there were foreign policy considerations to any of these prosecutions, i.e., what would happen to the big foreign politician, whomever he might be, whether it was a royal family or an elected official or an appointed official, and what would the fallout be? And Justice and the administration tried to gauge those one by one. But generally speaking, my experience was if there was a good case, very rarely would Justice back down and not proceed it, you know, under the general rubric of, you know, let the chips fall where they might. Mm-hmm. And they didn't worry. Now, there wasn't any major ally, as I recall, if you want to use that phrase, that ever was really crippled because of any prosecutions that we did, you know. So in that sense, there wasn't any major fallout, I guess.
So it may have been a big public scandal in these countries, but it didn't,
take
down the government or do something.
That's
like
correct.
That, so. Okay, all right. Another issue in the Lockheed case that was interesting was at least in the press reporting, one issue seemed to be the question of whether or not charges should be brought against the heads of the corporations involved. So in Lockheed, for instance, you had Carl Kachian, who was one of the heads. There was a question about whether or not to proceed on charges against him or other individuals involved.
Right.
How did you all make that decision?
Well, that kind of decision-making process still goes on today. When a major corporation commits a crime through one of its senior officers, do you charge the corporation alone, or do you charge the corporation and the CEO of the corporation? Or do you charge just the corporation and maybe the senior VP, or the sales manager of that country, whatever? How high do you go up? Now, typically, most prosecutors today, and back then was the case, do you try to work your way up the chain. If you can actually show that the CEO had knowledge of a bribe, and so on, and you felt you could prove it in court, then you would tend to indict the individual CEO. But there are a lot of factors that went into that. Could you prove the case against the individual CEO? Suppose the company comes in and says, look, we want to plead guilty and get this behind us, but we don't think you ought to charge any individuals. We'll take the, you know, so you factor that in. How good is your case? But there's always a tension between charging the CEO and the company, charging both of them or one, or just the one. Most times, quite often, my experience has been not only in prosecuting but in defending these cases, quite often the actual bribe activity is often kept from the knowledge of the top officers of the company. Now, what's the reason for that? Is it to give them cover, or is it to just, look, this is the way we do business. Everybody doesn't have to know. It's just like, for example, on a different level, a contracting officer in a small company might go out and pay a bribe to get a license, but to build something or do something, but the upper officers will never know.
Sometimes these contracting officials have an interest in making sure that this goes through because it brings in the business and makes them look good, right?
Exactly. So there's always that tension, and that certainly existed in the case of Carl Kachian. He did lose his job over it.
Right.
But he was never indicted, as I recall.
I don't believe so either.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, the Ford Motor Company was another prominent case during this period. I think it concerned a kickback given to a general in Indonesia on a $30 million contract. William Safire at this time was writing a lot of different articles about the Carter administration in general, but also criticizing what he saw as some connections between the administration and the business community, involved some corruption in a number of different areas. And he charged that at one point that that the Ford Motor Company was being given the quote-unquote kid glove treatment because of the connections between Carter and Ford chairman, Henry Ford II.
Yeah.
Do you recall that being a political case
at all?
Yeah,
I mean, Bill Safire was a gadfly. I mean, I knew him. In fact, I remember he came to my going away party when I left the Justice Department. And, you know, we just treated him like any other reporter, really. He didn't. I certainly, when I was in charge of it, I never called the shots in a political sense. In fact, in my own case, historically, as I mentioned earlier, I was a Democrat, worked for Bobby Kennedy part-time when he ran for the Senate in New York and so on. And then over the years, I progressed. By the time I left Justice in 1979, I was just about all the way there towards being Republican for a lot of different reasons. But during my whole time as a prosecutor, I never called the shots on a political basis. So any time a Safire on the one hand or Al Gore, who was always accusing us of going easy on people, he was the young congressman in charge of investigating committee, we just pretty much ignored it.
Yeah.
It's not, wasn't really a factor. And it isn't a factor. Justice has a great, Department of Justice has a great cadre of independent prosecutors, regardless of what their own political beliefs are. And we didn't pay a lot of heed to Safire.
Yeah. Was there a lot of public pressure on either the administration or the DOJ to bring prosecutions against these companies? I mean, was this a significant issue? Were people actually genuinely outraged by the idea that an American company would pay a bribe abroad?
I think, generally speaking, the American public attitude was they just didn't like the idea of American companies spreading their money around the world to sell products. And it was both, it was not a political issue, it was a general perception. And both the Ford and then the Carter administration, and continuing on, always wanted to have that out there. But the actual prosecution of individual cases, there really haven't been very many until recently. There's a lot of investigating, a lot of talking, a lot of settlements, a lot of voluntary agreements, and so on and so forth. But everything is much more heightened. For example, just today in this Walmart situation, I'm not involved in that case, but you know, there's been an enormous amount of publicity and whether Walmart is, should be prosecuted, and if so, how vigorously and whatever, whatever. I mean, it's really been heightened. Same thing with Halliburton. I did represent Halliburton for quite a while and still do in some cases. And Halliburton has always gotten pretty much hammered from the press for whatever the press thinks they did or did not do and so on. It blows hot and cold, I guess, is the answer.
Right.
I don't perceive that there is a burning desire to prosecute American companies for bribes paid overseas. Generally speaking, it depends on the nature of the bribe, who it's being paid to, what is being garnered as a result of it, because it's just such a, it's so prevalent even today all over the world on, on the facilitating payments. You know, I'm getting rather technical with you, but I don't think, my own estimate is that people are not that outraged by it. Still, it's a crime though. It'll always be on the books.
Right. There's one more case that I did want to ask you about, if you don't mind. The Burt Lance case, which was not directly a Foreign Corrupt Practices case, but there were at least some possible connections to foreign bribery abroad there. Would you mind telling me a little bit about that case?
Sure. Burt Lance, of course, was Jimmy Carter's campaign chairman. And when he became, when Jimmy Carter was elected, Burt Lance became head of OMB, which of course was then and still is now a very powerful position. we became aware of, this case resided in the fraud section. I was then the head of it. And we became aware of certain improprieties in this Bank of Calhoun that he ran, and shifting of monies around and so on and so forth. So we commenced an investigation. And ultimately, of course, the Attorney General had to recuse himself, he being Jimmy Carr.
It's all right, we can go back and look at the name later. That's
the Attorney General had to recuse himself. Mm-hmm. And the Deputy Attorney General, whose name was Peter Flaherty, had been the mayor of Pittsburgh, and he really wasn't equipped to supervise the case. He had no prosecutorial experience at all. So it was decided to appoint three independent career prosecutors to supervise the case. So again, I was called upon to do that myself as head of the fraud section. John Kenny, who was then a chief assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, and a third fellow by the name of Kono Namorado, who was then a head prosecutor in the tax division of the Justice Department. And so we supervised that prosecution, and ultimately it was actually prosecuted by attorneys in the fraud section where I was, along with the help of an assistant down there in Atlanta. And Burt Lance went to trial, and he was acquitted of impropriety. I can remember when we were looking at that case, so at one point, and Burt, when Lance came to Washington, I remember there was a headline, Richest Man in the Administration, you know, throws party in Georgetown House, brings in caviar from wherever. I was, you know, in these society columns. That particular day, we had his accounts day by day. Burt Lance had less in his account than most lawyers in the Justice Department. He had no money at all, but he was shifting money around. But anyway, he was acquitted, so that was the end of that case. There were some other special prosecutions that we had, too. We did Jimmy Carter's warehouse. We did that for a while until that was removed and sent to a particular special prosecutor.
Was that one also connected to Burt Lance?
Yeah, well, it was a peanut warehouse that Jimmy Carter had. His brother. Was, yeah, right.
Right, so, okay. All right, that's definitely a very interesting case. Yeah, that one didn't deal directly so much with foreign bribery.
That's correct.
And actually,
the Burt Lance case really had not a lot to do with foreign bribery.
I did see one article that said that he had helped out a couple of millionaires, Eugene Hawley and Roy Carver, who had paid a bribe in Qatar.
I'd forgotten that connection. Yeah. Okay.
And then Burt Lance, as I understand it, knew these gentlemen and helped arrange an appointment with a State Department official to talk about this case, because basically they had paid a bribe and expected to be granted an oil concession. And then that was eventually withdrawn from them, and they wanted to go to the State Department and complain.
Okay.
And so they went in and complained that, that we paid this bribe, and now we spent all this money, and now we're not getting our oil concession.
Okay. Yeah, I'd forgotten that aspect of it.
Yeah.
That had nothing to do with the prosecution.
Right, right.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
All right, now I wanted to talk a little bit about the process of drafting the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. This took place in 1976, 1977. Mm-hmm. Did the DOJ offer any input into that process?
Yeah, there was a lot of input. The staff is on Congress. I forget which committee it was written by. But anyway, there was a lot of input by Justice. We had some input in the fraud section. Mm-hmm. We, you know, obviously got the mail and wire fraud language put into it. You didn't have to be a genius to give that input. I mean, that was a logical place to sort of formulate the basis of the statute for jurisdictional purposes. And then for articulating the scheme with standard language that had been tested in the courts for many, many years. It really just had a mail and wire fraud statute overlaying, the mail and wire fraud statute, and overlaying that was this foreign bribery, foreign officials aspect. The other aspect that was as important, of course, was to have a books and records provision. So a lot of people don't realize that even today, that the you can have a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act without ever bribing anybody because of the books and records.
In practice, so, have cases been prosecuted on that?
The SEC has used it in injunctive actions. Yeah. Generally speaking, it hasn't been a tool in a criminal case as an independent prosecution, just books and records.
Right.
But it's there. You know, you have to keep accurate books and records, regardless, having nothing to do with paying a bribe or not paying a bribe.
Okay. We won't go too much into the twists and turns of drafting that legislation and when various contributions were made. But there were two sections of the act that I wanted to ask you about. The first is the so-called Eckhart Amendment, which apparently allowed payments payments to be made to foreign officials to expedite routine government services,
right,
quote unquote. So that if a certain types of payments were made, for instance, you know, to speed up a contract rather than to get a contract, it might not be considered illegal under the act.
Right.
Right. Can you tell me a little bit about how that that provision came about?
Well, it was pretty much acknowledged that from the get-go, when the statute was being written, that there are a lot of payments that are made around the world and in the U.S. that are just for purposes of expediting things. Bring your goods into port. You got to give $50 to this guy or that guy, or $100 or $200, whatever it might be, to get your goods unloaded. Sometimes it's more money than that, and sometimes the amount of money can add up to considerable sums, sometimes millions of dollars over a period of time. So the question is, what is a facilitating or an expediting payment? And to tell you the truth, that still has been ironed out right down to today. There's still a lot of confusion about that and a lot of controversy about that. The bill clearly acknowledges that there's room for facilitating payments. Sometimes, you know, you want to get your truck unloaded your goods unloaded at the port. And I keep using those examples because that's where they most often come up, at the customs level or at the entry of goods level. And in South America, wherever it might be, the guy's sitting there behind a desk, he's half asleep, you need him to go out and get his people to move things, so you give him some money. Does the U.S. really want to prosecute those cases? The answer is no. There's thousands, if not millions, of incidents of that. And you have to draw, you know, you have to decide, no, that's not what we had in mind.
Right. So, no.
So, therein lies the problem. Today, if you take all those, and even if you accumulate millions of dollars to a large corporation, it may still be, quote, in SEC terms, an immaterial amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, in some small companies, maybe it is a, quote, material amount of money, but the fact of the matter is, there's really no total agreement on what is or what isn't. That's why you have this advisory opinion. You know, you write to the Justice Department, you say, look, we're doing X, Y, and Z, is that okay? And sometimes they'll say yes, sometimes they'll say no, sometimes they'll say we can't give you an answer. You know?
And so it goes. Yeah.
Right.
The other provision of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that I wanted to ask you about is the so-called National Security Clause. This idea that if a payment is made with the knowledge of of certain U.S. government officials and written authorization, that it will be acceptable, and this stemmed from the apparent fact that many U.S. companies had cooperated either with intelligence officials or other officials in the government in part to transfer money to certain officials to get them to do what they wanted,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So this was written into the act. Did this actually come up during your time in office, or I'm sorry, well, in government service?
Not really. There were some cases that involved what's called gray mail, where you can't talk about, you know, what really went on. But it was not a big factor during, to my recollection, anyway, at least from my vantage point. The subject of passing money along to government officials with consent of the government.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a big factor that I can recall.
Okay. Now, while you were still working in DOJ, did any other countries come to the U.S. and ask for assistance in setting up their own version of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act? Or
occasionally there would be some liaison that was done. That was not necessarily my bailiwick. I was more in executions on the trial side of things, not on the foreign policy, treaty cooperation. That was not my bag, so to speak.
Right. Okay. All right, so we've talked a lot about your career in the Department of Justice. Have you dealt much with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act since you've returned to private practice or entered private practice?
Yeah, over the years, sure. I've represented probably, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40, 50 different companies with their FCPA problems. Some were pretty minor, others were more mm-hmm. major. The act has become, in the last 7 or 8 years, has become very active.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's a function of two things. One, the world has become much smaller. Economic advantage today by an American company depends on world markets. Whereas, really, it's funny, 40 years ago, you know, a company could do pretty well and never sell anything overseas. Now, every company has to be a worldwide international company. That's the way they have to think. That's the way they have to operate. And they have to operate under an international set of rules and so on and so forth. So there's more activity, foreign economic activity, number one. Number two, everything today is from my older vantage point is becoming more heightened than it was before. Conduct that was kind of overlooked years ago is perhaps a transgression or maybe a civil case or a dispute has now become a criminal case, so there's more activity. Number three, there was a change of personnel. The people who head up the fraud section now, or some of the people, are more aggressive and they're going after cases. Peter Clark, who headed up the group for many, many years, was very good. He was not particularly inclined to bring as many prosecutions as his successor was. And a lot of companies have signed these treaties, mm-hmm. a lot of other countries, so there's more talk about it.
From your perspective, is the law still accomplishing its purpose of preventing corruption abroad while also striking a balance between, say, U.S. economic interests and...
I think there's probably less inclination to do a major bribe, and a more of a, companies today are certainly trying to structure a program whereby they eliminate that. Every company today has a whole compliance program in place, every major company, so there's a lot less activity. I think at the highest levels, I think it's really had an effect. I think the low-level facilitating payments, whatever you want to call it, I think it's just as pervasive as it ever was. And I don't see it being eliminated no matter what we do. But certainly if any company were inclined to bribe a prime minister today, I doubt it would happen because of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And it's just a whole different time that we live in, you know. So I think it's had an impact, yes.
I understand that you just recently wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Yeah, this I started writing as an op-ed piece, and then the timetable was so short that I had to do it as a letter to the editor. Although it got pretty good treatment, it got three or four columns as a letter to the editor, which is quite large. It came about because of a FCPA sting case that occurred here in Washington before Judge Leon in the U.S. District Court. The government had set up a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act sting. They indicted 20, 22 different entities or companies for attempting to bribe Prime Minister of Gabon. It was all a sting operation. Was not true. It was an outrage, the case. The case was originally indicted with all 21 people, then it was broken up into five indictments, and then recomposed, and it wound up to be four or five successive trials. The first trial happened in the summer of 2011. Nobody was convicted, never hung jury. The second trial started in October of 2011, ended in January of 2012. One case was thrown out along the way, or the jury hung on all the others. The evidence was outrageous, the case was trumped up, it was a bad mistake. I think that case was prompted by the desire to really make a big sting operation of the FCPA, and it fell flat on its face. When I wrote this piece to the Wall Street Journal, it was after the trial had resulted in another hung jury, an acquittal of one defendant, but before a motion was being heard, the Justice Department was coming in to the courtroom that next week to say what it was going to do. And I wrote this article in anticipation of that, hoping that justice would do the right thing and get rid of the case, which is ultimately what happened. They just dismissed everything. But to me, it was a real black mark on a couple of fronts. One is that the sting operation was ill-considered. The FBI tactics were outrageous. The primary prosecution witness was a drug addict and an abuser of major degree. There were so many problems with the case, and after they got burned the first time around, they should have hung it up, but they went for a second. And at one point, it looked like they might try to go for a third, but they finally became wise. And so that case pretty much shocked me. So I wrote this letter.
Right.
And it's true of all kinds. There are a lot of cases that are being prosecuted today that I don't think normally are crimes. There are sometimes bad judgments.
Are you talking specifically about FCPA cases?
No, across the board, a lot of these corporate cases.
Mm-hmm.
I think the honest officials, you know, if you follow those cases at all, the dishonest, you know, depriving the people of the fair and honest services of an official, they get a little bit carried away. The Supreme Court had to bang that down. There's just not, in some instances, not enough thought being given to what you really need to have to show a criminal case. So that's one of the things I feel very strongly about today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in favor of good prosecutions. We have to have them. I'm not in favor of prosecutions that are brought to respond to headlines or pressure from one side or the other politically.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that the Justice Department, which has a long tradition of independent prosecution, hope it keeps that way.
But if you were looking into your crystal ball, do you see the level of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act cases remaining relatively high in the future, or do you think it's going to probably taper down a little bit?
I have a sense it's probably going to taper down a little bit. I'm not sure why I can say that, but I think I just think it will. I think that companies are more conscious of it. Prosecutors have made their point, so to speak. I think it will, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I could be dead wrong, too.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Beckler, looking back on your long career and involvement with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, do you have any final thoughts to add about that or anything else?
No, I love practicing law. I'll practice till I die. I'm never going to retire. Don't want to retire. I have too much fun practicing law. It's a great profession, and I'm happy to contribute to this little part of history.
All right. Well, we wish you many more years of career success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.